Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. Just before this episode, or maybe after this episode, I don't know which order it's going to come out in. Me and Juliana, we did another podcast with Jenny from Reading Envy. It's a Reading Envy science fiction book review podcast crossover episode where we talk about six different books because we each pick two each and we each talk about them. Juliana picked two books which have connections with this one. First of all, there was The Dying Earth by Jack Vance. She recently read that and we talked about that with Jenny. And also another book by an author who has something in common with the author that I'm going to be talking about today, Brandon Sanderson. We also talked about his Alcatraz versus the Evil Librarians book. So check out that other podcast as well if it shows up in the feed, or check out Reading Envy podcast too. So today I'm going to be talking about a book which I recently read, the first book in the series of the Broken Earth series by N.K. Jemisin. And I read that one a month ago or something, or 2 months ago, and I read it, and then it won the Hugo Award for this year, or last year, the 2016 Hugo Award for books that came out in 2015, and I enjoyed it. 4 stars, pretty good book. And then it seemed like the next book came out straight away, or just come out as well, so I was like, well, let's just check that out. So I downloaded the audiobook, and I've been listening to it over the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks, or whatever it's been on these last two work trips. It's a bit slower getting through. Now, this is obviously the second book in a series, or the middle book of a trilogy called The Broken Earth. Yeah, the first one was called The Fifth Season, and this one is called The Obelisk Gate. And it's a middle book, or it's the second book in a series, which always makes me think, well, how do I talk about this without spoiling the things that happen in the first book? So I will hopefully get through most of this book without spoiling anything that happens in the first book. I'll just do some hand-wavy stuff and some just referencing stuff. If you read this book, you'll understand what the plot points are that I'm referencing. And if not, well, you may or may not want to read this book when I get to the end of this one. But it is worth, no matter what my opinion are of The Obelisk Gate, I think that The Fifth Season, the first book in this series, does actually hold up as an interesting book and as a good reading experience, despite the fact that this second book in the series, this middle book in the trilogy, does not hold up to it, and I don't think it is as good and as satisfying in most ways. So there's a spoiler for this review. I'm going to give this second book, The Obelisk Gate, it's a big downturn in many ways after that first book. But still worth reading the first book in a series. I think this book doesn't make that first book work any less. You know, it could have just been a standalone novel. It could have just finished where, I mean, there's a few things that happen at the end and a few things go through and you're like, well, why did this character do this? And why did that happen like that? And what is this big mystery that's happening? And though some of those things are explained, or those questions are answered in this second book, but you know, sometimes it's best not to reveal all of the answers and discover all of, like, get through all of the mysteries as you go along. So anyway, this book starts off, well, let me put it this way: the last book there was three main characters that we were following along with their stories, and at the end of that book we get some, don't want to go into it too much, but one of the stories continues on into this book. And let me go across to my notes, because I made some notes as I was going through this, so I'll start from some characters. Yeah, so there's Essen, and Essen we followed in the first book, and she was the one who always had the chapters that were written in the second person. So you did this, and you did that, and you did this. And we kind of worked out who was the person telling Essen's story as we went through that book at the end, and now I kind of understand why it's being told. Because I was thinking, well, if it's in second person, normally if it's in second person, it's more of a literary device, because it doesn't always work out. It's like, how does the second person know what you are thinking? It's like, you are doing this, you are saying that, and you are thinking about this as you say it. Now, if you've got like some kind of third person narrator, you can say, well, the narrator is outside of the area, outside of the person, but knows what's going on, some omniscient narrator going on. Or if it's first person, of course, you know what you're thinking, even if it's, or I know what I'm thinking, even if it can be a flawed narrator. An unreliable narrator in that way. Whereas this is a second person. I was like, well, how does that character know what that person is thinking or has been thinking. And again, don't want to give away too many spoilers in this, but what happens to one of the another character? Put it this way, there's this character called Stone Eaters, and these are like these mythological beings, mythic characters who are like stone. They're made out of stone. They're kind of statues. They used to be humans, but they're humans who haven't turned, like who later turned into these stone monsters, Stone Eaters as they call it, and they eat stone. And we find out in this book that some of the stone that they eat, if they eat, because there's magic as well, and people get turned into stone. So if someone gets turned into stone, and then the Rock Eater eats that person, and I'm thinking, okay, so if the Rock Eater eats that person, we've discovered this actually happens a little bit in this second book, maybe they're not just eating, like, if they eat the brains of that person or the spirit of that person, kind of goes into them, and then they know what it is. So I'm thinking, well, maybe at the end of this story, Essen is going to be turned into stone and then eaten, and that's how this character, this Stone Eater character who's actually narrating these stories in the second, and it's not entirely clear that is happening, but there's stuff here in the second book which makes me think, ah, okay, that could be it. That's maybe why the second person narrator, the this character, knows what this character has been thinking. So even if it's told kind of like in second person and present tense, it's a weird one, but it works for me. This works as a narrative device. Sometimes these, you know, things happening in present tense or future tense or, you know, second person narrative gets in the way of my enjoyment of books. It didn't happen in the first book in this trilogy, the fifth season, and it didn't happen here in The Obelisk Gate. So we have Essen, and she has I don't actually know how to pronounce, I mean, I know how to pronounce some of these, but some of the spellings, I'm not quite sure. So in the first book, we had Damara and Sayonite and Essen. And in this book, we get Essen. And Damara in the first book was young, and Sayonite was kind of like in her, you know, kind of 20s, I guess. And then Essen was in her 40s. And here we get Essen going on. But then we get stories that following Nessen, which is... Nessen is Essen's daughter, and we kind of get a bit of a retread of what happened with Damara in the first book, but now with another young female origin, and origins are these people, these the kind of people who are born with this weird quirk where they can kind of control rocks and they can stop earthquakes happening. I talked about this in my first podcast about the first book, but these origins. She is also one. And in the first book, we had the character Damara who goes off and is looked after by guardians and goes into magic school. And she learns how to control herself and learns how to not kill people with her magical rock bending abilities. And then we kind of just get that same, not the same story, but a similar kind of story going on again in this book. And it felt a little bit like we were retreading ground. And I was like, well, didn't we have this kind of story being told? Like a similar young female magic-y kind of person who is standing up to the people who are trying to, you know, who are trying to control her and finding her own way and becoming more independent as you go through. And it's fine, but it didn't feel like anything new. I mean, even in the first book, going to a magic school and learning how to do magic school and that kind of thing, there was like a new take on that compared to other books where someone goes to a wizard school like Earthsea or Harry Potter, although I've not read Harry Potter, but you know, you can kind of get these things. What's the name of the wind book as well? Oh, come and learn how to control your magic and learn how to do this. And you're like, right, okay, I've seen this kind of stuff before, but it was actually done really well in the fifth season, the first book. Now in the second book, it's done just as well, but it doesn't seem to bring enough newness to what was new in the first book, the different take on that first book, which I'll talk about a little later. So we've got these, instead of having three chapters being told in different times, the first book was non-chronological because the different stories were said in different times and they were switching around between characters. And here there's a little bit of non-chronological because it actually starts off in the first book. Essen, the book kind of opens with her husband discovering that her children have this cursed magical ability. and he beats their son to death and kidnaps their daughter and leaves. And you're like, and then you see the rest of her story kind of follows on from that. That's Essen in the first book. And here, this second book starts with that scene, but being told from the father, Gija's point of view, and Nessun, the daughter's point of view. And Nessun comes in and realizes that Gija has beaten. So it starts off in the same place, and then she goes off in a different direction. And then we kind of catch up with Essen, what she was doing like a year later. And then, you know, but, and then, so that happens. So you're thinking, okay, what else happens in this book? And after all of the interesting stuff that was happening in the first book, and someone's going off to magic school, and someone is, you know, someone else who is at magic school has to, you know, learn more stuff when they're older, and they go off on a quest, and they've got to do this thing, and they find an obelisk, and then there's volcanoes going off, and this kind of stuff, and then in, you know, these another characters, there always seems to be stuff happening. There's always like things going on, and people doing stuff, and going like going places and discovering things, and going places and doing things. In this book, there's a little bit of going places at the start, where Nessun and Gija, they go across this kind of post-apocalyptic world together, fighting their way across and trying not to be mugged and trying not to, you know, trying not to be killed and getting all this thing. And they're trying to find a place where they'll be safe. Nessun will be safe, but also Gija, the father, says, hey, there's a place that we can cure you of your origin-ness, of your special cursed magical abilities. We'll save you, like we'll get you, we'll cure you of this, and there's some fun stuff going on there. There's another character that we follow a bit as well, which is Shaffer, the guardian. Now, in the first book, I thought this guy was a badass, obviously a bad character, like a not a good person, but an interesting person. And this book starts off, and we see a little bit of stuff from his point of view. And holy shit, he is still a badass and still not a good person. It's interesting to kind of follow a character who just goes, yes, and I will murder these children, and I will murder these adults, and I'll murder these children, and then I'll take this child. And we saw a bit of him in that first book, and I always thought he was one of the more interesting characters. And then he's back in this book, and we get a bit from his point of view at the start, and then he becomes, I wouldn't say a minor character, but he becomes just a side, like a supporting character in Nessun's story. And that relationship never really felt like it came together. Like, Nessun has already been party to a very abusive relationship with her father. And then, like, even while her father is kind of still being abusive to her, she kind of latches on to this other very abusive character. And this other abusive, this Shaffer the Guardian, not quite as abusive to her as we saw her being to Damara in the first story, but still, like, you're just like, wow, okay, so this book, like in the first book, is about, you know, characters being in control of each other and keeping control of themselves and controlling relationships and things, so that was there, but it kind of kept falling out. Like, it kind of, we kept on just going, oh wait, we'll have a bit of that, and then we'll go back across here, and we'll go back to Essen, and then back to Nessun, and then back to Essen. And then there's this whole middle part of this book, which I actually made a note of here. I said, quite a lull in the middle here. And I was remembering, because, put it this way, there's a lull, because what happens is that, like, we know the backstory of what's happened so far, and we kind of know that there's this mystery, and so much of this book is just Essen kind of having talks with Alabaster and these other characters, these Stone-Eater characters, about kind of what's happened so far in the world, and oh, and there's this bit of history, and that's like, but so much, and then, you know, and then there's Tonki, and Tonki goes and finds something in this underground community place, I think it's called Kastrima. And there's a bit of there, and it's like, well, what's the secret behind the place? How does this place work? Oh, there's this other kind of magic, and we're going to do this other kind of magic. And then there's these other mysterious things, and we're going to connect it with this one, and we're going to do more magic, and the magic's going to be more powerful. And then there's going to be some technology. There's definitely some science fictional influences here. Oh, there's like the precursor technology. But it was just like, Essen spends the entirety of this book in one location, and other people are exploring the location and going, well, what's this do over here, and what's that? But she's not doing it. So all of the times that we're learning about the this underground community. It's just she's meeting up with people and they're describing to her what they found out about this place. And all the times where there's some new magic involved, she's just like meeting up with people and they're kind of saying, oh, and this is how it works and this is how it works. And then she learns that, but she doesn't do anything with the magic really. I mean, there's a bit of killing people, but lots of people kill other people with their magic. I mean, it's one of the main things about being an origin in this book is that you kill people by accident, and sometimes you do it on purpose, and sometimes you do it by accident, but then sometimes you do it on purpose. Until, like, you know, like, I listen to this an audiobook, and it's like a 15-hour audiobook, and then like an hour before the end, she kind of does more stuff, and then it turns out that people knew all of the answers to this all the way along, and we were just getting the answers doled out to us. It was just like, this character already knows it, but they're not going to tell you this thing. And then they're going to tell you a little bit, and then they're going to tell you a little bit more, and then they're going to tell you a little bit more. And it really made me think, you know what happened at the end of the last book? If they'd have just been at the end of the last book, we found out this happened, and, you know, everything that we found out in the first book just happened. And then we just had like an hour extra, like a, not a prologue, an epilogue, like an hour epilogue of someone going, hey, you know, this big question that I had about this book, this is the reason for that. Oh, and you know about this kind of magic? Oh, there's another kind of magic like this. And then this kind of thing. And then so what I did, I listened to about a 15-hour audiobook of just somebody being taught stuff. Meanwhile, her daughter in a different place is being also taught some stuff. And they kind of, in parallel, discovering similar kinds of magic-y things, but not actually doing much with it, you know. Nessun goes off at one place and then just comes back again. So there's like half a chapter where she goes off and does something else and then comes back. There's a bit of a battle at the end. But like I say, it wasn't just a lull in the middle. It kind of felt like as soon as Nessun got to where she wanted to go and linked up with Shaffa, the Guardian, it kind of just went into a holding pattern. Now, what was in that holding pattern wasn't bad, but holy shit, was it grim. It was all like, you know, because this book is set at the beginning of the first book. It says, okay, we've got this person, and they're like, hey, should we do this? Yes, he's talking to someone. I don't want to give too much away, but at the start of the book, he's pretty much, hey, let's do it. Let's break the world. And the world breaks. And we've been told, I think, even in the prologue of the first book, it's like, you know, sometimes people say that the world is ending, but the world isn't really ending. What's actually happening is just lots of humans are dying, but the Earth will be fine. But this is a story about about the world ending. So you know it's going to be grim. And it is pre-apocalyptic and then apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic all at the same time. But it's just really grim, you know. Like in the first book, it was kind of, like, it says, oh, these comms, you know, so as soon as there's what's called a fifth season, as soon as, you know, because there's four not regular seasons, and then there's, like, these extinction-level events where all gases come out of volcanoes and cover the Earth and kill everybody off, or ash clouds come out, or there's just massive earthquakes that wipe out huge swathes of this mega Pangaea continent place that everyone lives. And that's, you know, it's not spring, summer, autumn, or winter. It's the fifth season where all bets are off in what might happen weather-wise and, you know, apocalypse wise and so what happens when a fifth season is declared, all the walls go up around around the communities, all the towns, you know, it's all stockpiled food, and if anyone comes along, well, they just shoot them and kill them. And there's always a thing like, oh, if these seasons last a long time, people might start eating each other. But in this book, it just gets really grim. It's just like people being killed, and then this character kills these children, and this character who you think is going to be, you think, oh, this is the main character who are meant to be alive. Well, they just killed children as well, and these are they just get killed. And it's just sort of like every main character in this book is just killing children, even if they're children themselves and they do it by accident. But then, like, when a book starts off with a father beating his young, you know, child, like his 4-year-old child, beating his child to death, and then doesn't really pick up in the, you know, like in terms of like lightness from there on in, it's just more grim. Now, of course, this is a middle book in a trilogy, and it always has that thing where you just go, okay, middle books in trilogy, generally a bit darker. They, you know, the story isn't so strong, but, you know, you got stronger characters because you know the characters now and you can spend more time with them. This book, it never really got past, and I actually made a note here where I said, in the first podcast that I did about this series, about the fifth season, I questioned like the sex adventures that happened in, you know, to one of these characters, and then there's like these pirate ship adventure interludes and stuff like that, and I was like, they get a bit silly, but you know, it's fun enough, but it's a bit silly, could do without them. And in this book, I would just longing for some sex adventures and some pirate ship escapade interludes, because there just wasn't any. Because while that first book, some of the stuff happened before the apocalypse, and some of the stuff happened during the apocalypse, and some of the stuff happened after the apocalypse. The stuff that happened before, generally the world was quite a nice place, you know, like la 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 la. And even though people are dying in the pirate ship escapades, it's sort of like, well, at least we're having fun and the sun's shining and it's, you know, a bit of lightness. And when they're having sex adventures, you're like, well, at least this threesome sounds like it. At least some people in this book are sounding like they are having fun. And in this book, just nobody was having any fun. Of course, it is post-apocalyptic, but like, and I'm not saying that I wanted that lightness in a book, but I did miss it. I did miss it for a book which felt like not a lot was happening, and it was really slow going. However, there is some good stuff in this book. For example, the mystery, the weird mystery of, like, it even said in the first podcast, and they were talking about a moon. Oh, something happened with a moon, and I'm like, well, maybe this is a moon, or maybe it isn't a moon. And we do actually get the full story of what the secret of the moon is. And then other things like, well, how does this magic work? And we do get a little bit more stuff about that. And then we get these ideas of, well, what was this? You know, so what, like, the answers that we are being told about the backstory, about the way the world works, all the world building in this book is actually really interesting. And the mysteries I thought were actually interesting to read about, because I do quite like fantasy mixed with like science fiction tropes and fantasy tropes. And in this case, you know, post-apocalypse tropes with, you know, like roving bands of people killing each other for food and to survive and cannibalism and stuff like that. All three of these things really appealed to me in a world-building sense. However, in this book, there was just no story to hang it on. And when there was some story, it was just kind of being told to us. It doesn't, none of it ever moved the characters. Well, some of it moved the characters along, but it never really, we never really learned anything more about the world through story. It was in the first book, like, they discovered stuff by going somewhere and digging something out of the ground and going, wow, this is new, what's this going on here? Or they discovered something about meat going and, like, having a confrontation with people and, like, learning new powers by doing that. And in this book, everything that is learned is just kind of recounted by other people, and none of the action, none of the narrative, none of the action kind of drives, like, nothing that anybody learns drives the plot forward, or nobody learns things as the plot goes. It's difficult to explain, really, what I'm trying to get at there, but yeah, it just there was a disconnect, a much more of a disconnect between the world building in this book and actually what we discover is going on. What else do we have here? Some other characters. Tonki thought was going to do some interesting stuff and did kind of do some interesting stuff, but then it was kind of brought up and then it was dropped, and I was like, oh, I quite enjoyed Tonki in the first book, and thought there was going to be some more interest, like, more stuff going on there with this this character, which a trans character, which is, you know, you don't get very often in fantasy books, really, where in that way. And another character, Lerner, who Essen gets a nose from her past, and then it turns up again, and you're like, oh, okay, this could be interesting, but nothing really happens with that relation. I mean, there's some relationship stuff that, but it doesn't really kick off. Shaffer the Guardian is there, but like, there was this really interesting sort of like, oh, there's this thing and he's being controlled from outside. Like, at the start of this book, it's sort of like something gets into his head and is being controlling him from the inside, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be really interesting, we're going to discover what this is going on, and then we never see anything from inside his head anymore, and kind of just drops away. So it's a real pity that the characters didn't really, except for the two main characters, which are fine, but, you know, didn't really blossom like they did in the first book. Some notes on the writing. Mostly the writing is really good, except for, put it this way, I don't mind that all the stuff was in second person. I can see a lot. One of the characters said everything from the second person. I can see why some people would find that difficult. For me, one of the most difficult things is, which I've talked about this on many podcasts, is swear word substitution. And it doesn't make so much sense in this book when it's like a very adult book. When a book starts off with a man beating his child to death with his bare hands and then kidnapping his daughter and going away, and then the book later on turns to cannibalism and massive oppression and death and many more children being killed. This is not a children's book. So I was like, well, why does, like, you don't really need to be, replacing the swear words all the time with rust. Everything is rusting and rusting this and rusting that. And it got to the point where I was like, there's just too much swearing in the book, and the swearing isn't even offensive because it's just saying rusting, even though people do say fucking and other things at the same time. Like with sometimes this rusting fucker fucking thing. And right near the end of the book, there was like this very fun, clever kind of swearing, like rusting buckets of salty piss or whatever. It's something, and it was sort of like what someone wasn't. It wasn't just a swear word substitution for fucking for rusting. It was like using the word rusting as rusty buckets. You know, in the same way that you don't. I don't know. It was one of those things that it kept on drawing me out of the book. How often somebody was swearing. It was everything was rusting this and rusting that. It's just not good enough swearing when it, and it can't. Took me out of the book more often than not. And yeah, and another note I made a note here, circumference. Now I remember actually what this is. Twice in the book, something is measured by, it had a circumference of about 2 inches. And I'm like, you know, a circumference of about 2 inches is about, it means that, you know, I know pi, and that means the radius is only this, and then the diameter is that. So when they actually measure these bugs turn up, which are quite interesting bugs, and they turn up and they're like, yes, they're about 3 inches of, oh no, 2 inches in circumference. And I was like, that's a really tiny bug. And then they were explaining it and describing it. I was like, I think she mixed up diameter with circumference. And it happened twice in this book. Normally I wouldn't make a note of that kind of stuff, but when it happened the second time, I'm like, circumference is a dodgy way of describing something. Just a small note. Right, so when I posted about the first book, somebody posted on the goodreads.com forum, the SFBRP listener forum, listener group on goodreads.com. I'm just mumbling because I'm trying to bring it up on my phone. I save the page here. And someone in the discussion thread, episode feedback, someone said, this one is regarding the episode SFBRP number 311, N.K. Jemison, The Broken Earth, number one, the fifth season. And this is Lindsay, and he actually explains a few mistakes that I made. He says, actually, they're called fifth seasons. I mentioned this before in the first podcast. I thought they were just called seasons, but they're shortened as seasons. And the fifth seasons, as I explained earlier on in this thing. So that was good to know. And some stuff about the past history of it, which I was just trying to, I guess, what happens in a lot of these podcasts is that I don't want to get too much into the weeds of this. I kind of just want to give the broad overview. And I combined an older empire that had fallen with a remnant of the empire and combined them into one. I think it was just my being vague and a bit lazy and stuff like that. And then I actually speculated at the end of the last book, at the end of the podcast, where I thought the book was going. I actually thought, hey, this book is set on a moon on a gas planet, but you can't see the gas planet because it's tidally locked, and that's what's creating all of the earthquakes and stuff, because, you know, some variations in the orbit as it goes round, and it break, you know, and it makes planets wobble, you know, a bit like these the moons of Jupiter and stuff, which are tidally locked, they're locked tidally, and they don't spin around. So if you're actually standing on one side of the moon, you never see Jupiter. And also, it causes massive tidal things inside the planet, and it keeps the planets very, I was going to say volcanically active, but, you know, the volcanoes and the earthquakes are there as a byproduct of it being so close to a massive bit of gravity. That's not the case in this book, actually. So I was wrong about that, and I'm actually happy to be wrong, because what happens in this book is actually more interesting than that. It's actually a better science fiction premise, which is mixed in with the fantasy book. And he says, I was thinking it was very far in the future where the continents have merged again, as they're supposed to be doing around 250 million years in the future. So that was Lindsay who said that. And then Jenny from Reading Envy, she said, I know The Killing Moon, which is another book by N.K. Jemisin, was about a moon of a gas planet, but I'm not sure she'd do that twice. And I didn't realise that N.K. Jemisin had already done a book about a moon of a gas planet. And yes, it would be a bit weird if she did that in two books in a row, or in two different fantasy series in a row, both of them set on moons of gas planets. So yes, I was actually wrong about that. Like I said, that the science fictional idea at the heart of this is actually a really good mixture of science fiction and fantasy. And also in the book, I call the origins, which are these cursed humans with this curse of being able to control or not very well control magical powers of rocks and stuff like that. I call them Rogers because that's what it sounded, or Roggers. That's what it sounded like to me in the audiobook version of this. But it's actually Ragger, and it's actually Rogers as in a Roger. But I think that was just me hearing the audiobook incorrectly. So let's move down to another comment in this, because I actually said in this thread I will address these comments in the podcast that I do about the follow-up. Jenny says, I'm definitely interested in the meaning of what was revealed at the end with the obelisk, and they were there from the beginning. I just couldn't put them in context, so I ignored them. And it's actually interesting that at the start of the first book, he actually says, there's these things called obelisks, but ignore them. They're not important. They're not going to be important in this book at all. Don't think about the obelisks. They're going to be there for the book, but just ignore them. And Jenny seemed to be completely taken in by that. So she just ignored them. And of course, the whole book's about these obelisks. And even in this book, it's called The Obelisk Gate, so you can kind of see. And then he says, Jenny says, Luke, I'm interested in what you think about Jemisin's intentionality in writing about racism without calling it racism. She is pretty explicit about this in the Lightspeed magazine interview and also in the New York Times. And so I just finished this book this afternoon, and then I looked up this Lightspeed magazine interview that she did, which is actually just a transcript or an edited transcript of a podcast interview that she did, but I just read it. And she does get into this because N.K. Jemisin is a black female author, and it says in this interview that she was influenced by what was going on with the Ferguson protests and Black Lives Matter and all of that kind of stuff. And she put that, her experience of that, into this book. And she mentions some other things as well. I brought this up on the podcast, which you might have listened to, that about with Reading Envy podcast that me and Juliana and Jenny did together. And I just briefly mentioned a book called The First All Americans. And it's about Native Americans' children being collected together and put into these special schools where, you know, part of it was like, oh, it's a charity to help these people get educated so they can fit in with society. But you also realize big parts of it is like, well, we've got to make these savages more, more civilized. And it's not very little to do with the education, or rather than the de-education, the deprogramming of their original cultures and their original languages, and to try and replace it with the white European culture. And I did notice that was an influence in this first book, where Damaria, or whatever her name was, in the first book, she was taken to this magic school, and it did feel very much like what the colleges that were described in this book, The First All-Americans, which is talking about an American football team, which came from this Native American, the Indian schools for the reservations, where they would take the kids away from their families and put them all together and then try and re-educate them and integrate them into modern society. But not really, because it was just a place. It's like a cross between a deprogramming camp and a concentration camp and all that kind of things put into one. And I did realize that those references were there, and but I didn't quite pick up like how intentional that was. I thought it was much, but like in a way, it seemed like that N.K. Jemisin, being a black author, it's not that she seems to be writing about racism, but she was letting this her experience of racism and her knowledge of it and being a black woman in America to come through in the book and inform what the characters went through in the books themselves. So I did pick up on that, although I didn't realize how intentional it was. She was like, yes, I was actually watching the Black Lives Matter protests and, you know, reading up about it and following it on Twitter and seeing the protests, and I went to protest myself, and then I kind of wrote that into the book, those kind of feelings for the characters. So I didn't realize that how much intention it was, although I did realize it was influencing the book. So I did find that quite interesting, and the interview in Lightspeed magazine is actually an interesting interview. It doesn't touch much on it. I mean, it's only quite late in the interview where it gets into these deeper things. It's much more about the writing process of the book and how it's published. But that is interesting at the end there. So some of it I picked up on, some of it I didn't. The weird thing is, though, about she's writing about racism without calling it racism. I want to be really careful about this when I talk about this, is because I've been as a white guy, a white male guy in his 30s, talking about racism, not really my kind of place to do it. Someone actually mentioned on Goodreads, I shouldn't talk about racism from that point of view. And it came up when me and Juliana were talking about the book Quantum Night by whatever the guy is who wrote that one. Is it Quantum Night? What was the name of the... by Robert J. Sawyer, how he kind of invented a new form of racism. He kind of categorizes people into these different things and then invents new ways for them to be... profiled, and ways for them to be discriminated against, and they're saying, well, that isn't racism. And I was about, all I could come back was, even at the time I was talking about that, I didn't know what word to call it. Like, it was some kind of discrimination, and it's about something that you were born with, and so if it's something you're born with, it isn't racism. But like, what is the word to call this? So I acknowledge I'm not the most qualified person to talk about race issues and all of that kind of stuff. You know, a large part is because of my background. You know, I haven't experienced racism in that way. You know, this is not my lived experience. However, and I don't want to say however, and now a white guy's opinion, what I want to point out is that I find it very difficult to... it's not that I find it difficult. There's a disconnect when I read a book like this about how people are treated in this book. There's a massive disconnect between fantasy books and real-world books, and what characters go through as fantasy characters and what we go through in this real world. In this book, the characters who are being discriminated against are people who are randomly born with magical powers that accidentally kill people. And this is what I say, this is what I was trying to say before, is that what these characters then have to go through is, it's, you know, it's kind of, and I don't want to sound insensitive because I'm getting to a bigger point in a minute, it's like that the racism is justified within the context of the book. If there are people who can, just with the power of their mind, accidentally kill entire villages, it's kind of understandable for the people who don't have that power to be afraid of them, to be, you know, to have the phobia, you know, of the other. Like, and it's kind of understandable that these people are sent away from the villages and the towns that they're born into and put into a big castle with the rest of them, so they can't, you know, and guarded and can't, you know, harm other people accidentally and stuff. It's understandable. And that's what I was trying to say about, like, the lived experience of racism from a black woman in America. That really makes those, you know, and bringing in the influence from the Black Lives Matter and all the protests and people, what people have to live with in the real world, really informs that. Which brings me on to my main point, which I don't want to be misrepresented, or I don't want to misrepresent my thought process too much, but my main point is that what this book says about racism in the real world is all the more interesting, because this is what the Black Lives Matter movement seems to mean, or seems to come out of. Like, every, you know, week or every few days when white policemen shoot and kill and break and destroy the lives and destroy the communities and destroy families of young black men generally, or people who are stopped in traffic stops and things, and just people, just, you know, black young black men and black people just going around their lives and being killed. What I realize, though, is what we have in this book is what it's sort of like the fantasy of what it's like to be a white police person, police officer living in America surrounded by black people. It's like they are treating black people as though, just with the power of the black person's mind, they can suck all of the energy, all the heat out of the thing, and kill entire villages, or just accidentally kill people, or just with the power of their otherness, be actually as dangerous as the origins in this book. And this is the incredible thing about this book and about this series, which I didn't talk about in the first book because I thought, oh yes, it's about racism. But this is, you know, reading this article and being asked to talk about that. That's what I feel in this book, is that if you think that black people are as dangerous as the origins in this book, it's understandable by the police that they shoot first and ask questions later. And I'm not saying I'm not condoning anything, obviously not. And it's awful, and I find it terrible, but that's what this book is about. It's like, if you live in the white supremacist fantasy world, you should be locking up black people. And if you live in that white fantasy world, that's like, you're... But the only way that can be true is if you're literally in a fantasy story where black people with the power of their mind can hurt people from a distance and kill people from a distance and wipe out entire villages or entire police forces or whatever is going on inside the brains of white police officers when they shoot black men. Like, the only thing that makes sense to me to understand how dangerous they think unarmed black people are at traffic stops, the only way it makes sense to me is if they literally think they are like X-Men with magical powers. And I didn't really make that connection until I was, you know, asked to talk about this by Jenny in this comment after I'd already reviewed the first book. And when I actually, like, when she says, I'm interested in what you think about this intentionality, racism without calling it racism. The point is, it's the only way that racism makes sense is if you live in a world where the people that you're racist against have magical powers to affect your life. Because you know what? They don't have... There is no powers for anyone to affect your life. Like, if they're not angry with a gun pointing at you, there is no harm that can come to you as a police officer. And there's never a reason to shoot. I'm very much an absolutist against, you know, for gun control. You know, I totally believe in a world where nobody should be armed at all, and I think probably the only way to ever, you know, stop violence from police against black people that destroys people's lives in the way that it can do, or at least kill them. I mean, there's no way to root out systematic racism in that way, but just like, the police aren't allowed to shoot anyone. That's it. No guns. Or if you ever fire your gun, you're fired and you're not allowed to have a gun anymore and you're no longer a police officer anymore. I mean, it has to be like this zero tolerance thing of just, okay, no guns for anyone anymore. No guns for the police, no guns for anyone. And that's kind of how I think the world should be. And I don't want to get into any gun control debate. But like, the only reason that the thought processes in these police officers' mind could ever make sense to us is if they are literally ascribing magical powers to black people to harm them in ways which is just not borne out by like any evidence or any real experience. You know, there just isn't times when I don't even want to get into it further because I'm talking outside of my world, but I think if you want to get a glimpse into the mind of racist American police officers who kill black people, imagine in their heads black people can literally cause the end of the world or literally wipe out entire towns or kill people accidentally with their mind. It's the only way that racist view makes sense. Anyway, let's move on a bit to... more of these comments in this thread. Lindsay said, yeah, we found out what's going on in the next book. Stevie said some other bits and pieces. And then he said, let's slip a spoiler at the end of the podcast. Actually, I did, yes, last time. Oh, no, it was obviously in a later comment. Oh, yeah, Stevie also says, I'm not a fan of Obelisk Gate at all. Interesting to hear Luke's take. I'm also not a great fan of this second book. However, I will, at this point, before wrapping up my review, do the Audible plug. If you want to help support the podcast, you can go to audibletrial.com/SFBRP and you can get one book for free if you sign up for a free trial. The way it works is there's like 180,000 audiobooks. I would suggest, though, actually, listening to the audiobook of The Fifth Season, because it's much better than this book, and you can get it for free. And when you do that, you help support the podcast, and you get a book for free, and you'll sign up, like I do, for a Audible trial account, and then you get a book per month, or 2 book credits per month, and from then on, you just keep listening to as many audiobooks as you want. If you don't like a book, and you want to return it, there is a no-questions-asked book return policy. You can't do that on your first book, on your trial membership book, but anytime from then on you just like, you listen, start listening to a book and you're like, I don't like the narrator and this, the book isn't working for me, I want my money back, and you do, you just get your credit back. This book is narrated by Robin Miles, who does a very good job of this book, narrating it, and this is about 14 hours long, this book. Let me actually quickly look at how long the first book was. Oh no, I don't have this, and I'm clicking on the wrong one. No, I don't actually have the length of this book. View book details, is that going to work? The first book, The Fifth Season, is also about 15 hours long. So you get a 15-hour audiobook, 15 hours worth of entertaining, a Hugo Award-winning book from last year, if that will sway you at all. Probably wouldn't me. But yeah, check it out. audibletrial.com/SFBRP. So that's going to really wrap up my talk about this book. I've enjoyed it. I'm going to give this book 2 stars because it really didn't land with me. First book, 4 stars. This is a big drop off in terms of stuff happening, and just the craft of the storytelling didn't really come together. And it's not that I wish I hadn't have read it. It's just that I wish all of the material, all of the, you know, revealing of the secrets of this and that, it could have just been an hour. It could have just been, hey, there's a previous book that we just, which was 14 hours long. This book is another 14 hours, but we could have just made the first book 15 hours or 16 hours long rather than 14 hours, and you'd have got all of this, or you could have got much of the same stuff. And yeah, this book is just way more bleak. So I really did find myself not struggling to continue on, but I'd listen to it a bit and listen to about half an hour and then just be like, and then just put on a podcast and listen to some comedy podcast and stuff. And then I'd come back to this and listen to another 10 minutes and just be like, you know what, I'm not really feeling this. And then, you know, go on to some other things. So, yeah, 2 stars. It didn't really land very well with me. So you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge on Twitter. And you can follow me on Instagram. So if you want to keep up with my travels, Instagram is where I'm posting like videos of me traveling and stuff and being attacked by monkeys as I was in Gibraltar and pieces of me juggling, because that's what I am. I'm a professional juggler. So check that kind of stuff. On Instagram at Luke Burridge on Instagram too. You can become my friend on goodreads.com and I can see what you think of this book, which I haven't done here. I just looked at the feedback on the goodreads.com SFBRP listener group discussion forum, where you can chat with other people who have read the same books as me and listen to the podcast too. So check that out. And you can email me, luke@juggler.net. If you've got any questions or suggestions of books to read, you can do that via Gmail. You get luke@juggler.net, and it arrives here in my... I'm looking at my phone in my hand. I was looking at Instagram. There's Instagram and Twitter, and then Gmail is the app that I use. So you can check that out as well. The next book I'm going to be reviewing is... Oh, I'm not really sure, actually. Nope, don't have a... another book. Oh, Memories of Ice by Stephen Erickson, which is a fantasy book that I started getting into it. But I've mostly been reading fantasy books recently. Let's have a look. Yeah. Golem and the Genie, Aspect, Emperor, Judging Eye, 3 books there. Broken Earth, 5th Season, Pavane, and then this book. So yeah, lots of fantasy books. So I might get back to more science fiction. There's a book here that I have as an audiobook, We by Evgeny Zamyatin, which was meant to be one of the books which was an influence for 1984, which I've never got read, one of those historical nuggets of science fiction from early 20th century, which I've never actually read, so I might listen to that as an audiobook. That's only a few hours, 6 hours long, so I'll probably get the answer next. So that's it for me for this episode. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.